This CLE is based on New York State appellate decisions addressing issues related to civil procedure. The decisions summarized here were issued in February of 2019 and have been collected in an update pamphlet, which constitutes the written materials for this CLE. The first case has to do with appeals and the need to preserve the status quo when an appeal is pending. Here, the appeal was deemed moot by the time it got to the appellate court because it was related to the construction of a power plant, and the construction had continued during motion practice and during the time that the appeal was pending. The Fourth Department held that the Sierra Club's petition, which sought to vacate permits issued to allow the respondents to operate a natural gas and biomass power plant, was properly dismissed as moot. The petitioners didn't seek a temporary restraining order or any other measure to preserve the status quo during the legal proceedings, and the plant became operational. The court wrote, "Litigation over construction is rendered moot when the progress of the work constitutes a change in circumstances that would prevent the court from rendering a decision that would effectively determine an actual controversy. The primary factor in the mootness analysis is a challenger's failure to seek preliminary injunctive relief or otherwise preserve the status quo to prevent construction from commencing or continuing during the pendency of the litigation. Generally, a petitioner seeking to halt a construction project must move for injunctive relief at each stage of the proceeding. The failure to preserve the status quo is entirely the fault of petitioners here, who waited until the last possible day to commence this proceeding, failed to request a temporary restraining order, failed to pursue an injunction with any urgency, waited until the last possible day to take an appeal, spent 9 months perfecting the appeal, and failed to seek injunctive relief from this court until approximately 1 year after the entry of judgment." The next case is Calhoun on page 7. It's a case that deals with whether an action brought, a civil rights action, probably brought under 42 U.S.C. 1983, was frivolous. The Fourth Department reversed Supreme Court and held that the award of attorney's fees to the prevailing party, the defendant here, pursuant to 42 U.S.C. 1988, based upon the finding that plaintiff's action was frivolous, should not have been granted. The plaintiff had sued the county, claiming that her employment was terminated in retaliation for her complaints about the special education provided to her son. The court said, "A claim may not be deemed groundless where, as here, the plaintiff has made a sufficient evidentiary showing to forestall summary judgment and has presented sufficient evidence at trial to prevent the entry of judgment against him or her as a matter of law. Although the civil rights allegations here may have been weak, we can't deem plaintiff's claim frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation." The next case is Kindred Healthcare, which is on page 8, and it has to do with an exception to the waiver of attorney-client privilege called the common interest privilege. First Department held that the common interest privilege applied to a memorandum by plaintiff's general counsel. The court said, "The motion court properly held that a legal memorandum prepared by plaintiff's general counsel and addressed to its chief executive officer, which provided a summary and analysis of its pending litigation matters, including the litigation at issue, and subsequently shared with potential merger partners during the due diligence period pursuant to a common interest agreement, was privileged and protected from disclosure." The court wrote, "The common interest doctrine is a limited exception to waiver of the attorney-client privilege and requires, one, the underlying material qualify for protection under the attorney-client privilege, two, the parties to the disclosure have a common legal interest, and three, The material must pertain to pending or reasonably anticipated litigation for it to be protected. The record here demonstrates that the common interest agreement was entered into in reasonable anticipation of litigation. Next is the Vogric, that's V-O-G-R-I-C, case on pages 8 and 9. It's a severance case. It was a slip and fall, and one of the two defendants filed for bankruptcy. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff in this slip and fall case was entitled to severance of the action against the property owner, which was Pathmark, a supermarket, which had filed for bankruptcy, from the action against the snow removal contractor named Peterman. The court said, generally, the balance of the equities lies with plaintiff when severance is sought because the case against one defendant is stayed pursuant to the bankruptcy law, and that is particularly so in this personal injury action where a delay would be prejudicial to the plaintiff. As the prejudice to the plaintiff in being required to await the conclusion of the bankruptcy proceeding before obtaining any remedy outweighs any potential inconvenience to Peterman. Next is the Holloway case on pages 9 and 10. It just stands for the proposition that the doctrine of collateral estoppel applies to arbitration awards. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held that collateral estoppel controlled the proceeding concerning firefighter health benefits that were provided for in the collective bargaining agreement. The issue had been resolved in prior arbitration proceedings for firefighters who had retired before 2010, and the current proceeding was brought on behalf of firefighters who have or will retire after 2010. The court said, arbitration awards are entitled to collateral estoppel effect and will bar a party from relitigating a material issue or claim resolved in the arbitration proceeding after a full and fair opportunity to litigate. Next is Cates, K-A-T-E-S, on pages 10 and 11. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the medical malpractice action should not have been dismissed as untimely. Plaintiff raised questions of fact supporting the application of the continuous treatment toll of the statute of limitations. The fact that plaintiff may have considered bringing a malpractice action against one of the doctors did not signal the termination of treatment. The court wrote, although plaintiff requested her medical records and consulted with attorneys in 2010, the mere consultation with an attorney to explore a potential malpractice claim does not by itself terminate a course of treatment. Moving to the Goodman case, which is on pages 12 and 13. The issue here is whether the bankruptcy trustee could take advantage of CPLR 205 to recommence a lawsuit within the 6 months of the dismissal. The Second Department held that the bankruptcy trustee could take advantage of that statute. The timely filed action was dismissed because the debtor didn't list the suit as an asset in the bankruptcy filings. The court wrote, dismissal of the 2013 action was not based upon a voluntary discontinuance, lack of personal jurisdiction, or neglect to prosecute, or a final judgment on the merits. CPLR 205A is applicable even though the 2013 action was dismissed based on the debtor's incapacity to sue. The extension provisions of CPLR 205A are available to a plaintiff who seeks to recommence an action, notwithstanding that the prior action upon which the plaintiff relies was invalid in the sense that it contained a fatal defect. In this case, the plaintiff, a debtor's bankruptcy trustee, seeks to recommence a personal injury action as the debtor's successor in interest. As the debtor's successor in interest, the plaintiff has the capacity to commence this action to recover damages for the debtor's alleged personal injuries. Consequently, the plaintiff is not seeking to enforce any rights separate and independent from those asserted by the debtor in the prior action. Next is the Loeffler case on page 13. It has to do with a default judgment. The Second Department, reversing the Supreme Court, determined that the motion to vacate the default in this dog bite case should not have been granted, but a full evidentiary hearing was required to determine the appropriate amount of damages. The court wrote, "A court has the inherent power to set aside excessive awards made upon default, despite the fact that there's no reasonable excuse for the default. An unwarranted and excessive award after inquest will not be sustained, as to do otherwise would be tantamount to granting the plaintiffs an open season at the expense of a defaulting defendant. We agree with the Supreme Court's determination to stay enforcement of the default judgment and the settlement agreements based upon that judgment and to direct further discovery." Next is the Flowers case on page 14. The expert testimony was excluded because the notice that the defendants were going to have an expert testify was late. The Fourth Department held that the defendants in this Labor Law 241 action were properly precluded from offering expert testimony because of late notice. The court said, "The court determined that there was a willful failure to disclose because prior to jury selection, defendants' attorneys knew that they intended to present testimony from the psychiatric expert, but they didn't disclose the expert until the day after jury selection began, which violated the court's directive that defendants disclose an expert as soon as they knew of an expert. Although the record establishes that plaintiff was aware of the possibility that defendants would call an expert psychiatrist, he was prejudiced by the tardiness of the disclosure, both because it impaired his ability to discuss the relevant issues during jury selection and because it hamstrung his opportunity to retain an expert psychiatrist of his own." Next is the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank case on page 15. It just stands for the proposition that a judge should not take it upon himself or herself sua sponte to dismiss a complaint unless there are very extraordinary circumstances. The Second Department reversed Supreme Court and held that the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed this foreclosure action. The court said, "A court's power to dismiss a complaint sua sponte is to be used sparingly and only when extraordinary circumstances exist to warrant dismissal." Next, on page 16, it's Bank of New York Mellon, another foreclosure case, this time involving the statute of limitations. The Second Department held the prior action for foreclosure accelerated the debt, and the subsequent stipulation of discontinuance did not de-accelerate the debt. So the foreclosure action was found to be time-barred. The court said, "The plaintiff failed to raise a question of fact as to whether it affirmatively revoked its election to accelerate the mortgage within the 6-year limitations period. Its execution of the stipulation of discontinuance did not, by itself, constitute an affirmative act to revoke its election to accelerate. Since the stipulation was silent on the issue of the election to accelerate and did not otherwise indicate that the plaintiff would accept installment payments from the defendant." Next is the Gowan case on pages 16 and 17. It's a forum non conveniens case. The First Department held that defendant's motion to dismiss on forum non conveniens grounds was properly denied. The suit sought the return of a painting allegedly looted by the Nazi-occupied French government. The court wrote, "In weighing the relevant factors, the court correctly observed that plaintiff and several defendants maintained residences in New York. Although defendants suggest that France is the more appropriate forum, they also submitted evidence that the matter would be time-barred in France, which is an important factor to consider. This court observes that retaining this action would not be particularly burdensome. New York has previously entertained actions concerning Nazi looting of art during World War II. That the originals of some documents are located abroad doesn't require dismissal, and the court noted that key documents had already been translated for the court. Next is Southwestern Investments. On pages 17 and 18, it's a pleading case. The damages allegations in a fraud cause of action were deemed deficient here. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the motion to dismiss fraud causes of action should have been granted because the allegation of compensable damages was deficient. Plaintiff was a debt-buying company and commenced this action alleging that the defendants fraudulently induced it to purchase additional debt portfolios by misrepresenting the terms of the financing arrangement. The court wrote, damages are to be calculated to compensate plaintiff for what was lost because of the fraud, not to compensate for what might have been gained. There can be no recovery of profits which would have been realized in the absence of fraud. Next is the Ramirez case on page 18. It just reiterates the rule that common law indemnification is only available to someone who is vicariously liable as opposed for liability for that party's own negligence. The court said, a party cannot obtain common law indemnification unless it has been held to be vicariously liable without proof of any negligence on its own part. Next is the Shaw case, which is on page 19. It's an unusual case where a plaintiff was prohibited from bringing a suit in New York because of misconduct in a related case in Delaware. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the plaintiff's personal injury action should have been dismissed because of plaintiff's misconduct in a Delaware court proceeding. The New York personal injury action alleged plaintiff was injured in a physical fight with the defendant, which stemmed from the Delaware litigation. The Delaware court found that plaintiff had engaged in deplorable misconduct by accessing defendant's privileged attorney-client communications, deleting relevant documents, and lying under oath. The court said, plaintiff's improper and willful access of defendant's privileged communications with his lawyer and spoliation of evidence supports dismissal of his claims in this action, and they cite CPLR 3103C and CPLR 3126-3. Among the materials improperly accessed here was a privileged memorandum from defendant's counsel about his strategy concerning the incident underlying this action. Plaintiff's counsel referred to the contents of some of the privileged communications during motion practice in this litigation. Since plaintiff's knowledge can never be purged, and he would carry that knowledge into any new attorney-client relationship, we find that dismissal of the complaint is the only practicable remedy. Next is the Boland case, which is on page 20, and it has to do with when evidence submitted in reply papers should be considered. The Second Department held Supreme Court should have considered evidence submitted by the defendant in its reply papers. The court wrote, the evidence submitted by defendant in its reply addressed arguments made by the plaintiff and the plaintiff's expert in opposition to its motion. Thus, the court should have considered that evidence. So, because the reply papers, the defendant's reply papers, addressed matters that were raised by the plaintiff in opposition to the defendant's motion, the evidence presented in the reply should have been considered by the court. Next is the Bosung case, which is on pages 21 and 22. It has to do with the statute of limitations as it applies to an attempt to amend the complaint. First Department held that the statute of limitations was not told by the motion to amend the complaint, which was made before the statute ran, because the supplemental summons was not attached to the motion papers. Next is Matter of Foreclosure, which is on page 22. It's another statute of limitations case, and it deals with the interrelationship between the CPLR and the real property tax law. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the respondent's motion to vacate a tax foreclosure judgment shouldn't have been granted. The court explained that an extension of time pursuant to CPLR 2004 should not be granted where the real property tax law addresses the statute of limitations issue. The court said, the Court of Appeals has emphasized that as a general rule, there should be no resort to the provisions of the CPLR in instances where the real property tax law expressly covers the point in issue. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this CLA, which is based on the civil procedure decisions that were released by our New York State appellate courts in February 2019. The verification code is TRUSTEE, T-R-U-S-T-E-E. Again, the verification code for this February 2019 civil procedure CLE is TRUSTEE. The next case is on pages 23 and 24. It's U.S. Bank National Association. It's a Court of Appeals case, which again deals with the statute of limitations and the ability to recommence a suit after it's dismissed pursuant to CPLR 205. The Court of Appeals held that the trustee's breach of contract action in this residential mortgage-backed securities case was properly dismissed without prejudice, which allowed the plaintiff to refile pursuant to CPLR 205, which allows a suit to be refiled within 6 months of a dismissal that is not on the merits. The contractual sole remedy provision, which requires that the defendant be notified and given the opportunity to repurchase any mortgages deemed defective, was not complied with, and the timely complaint was dismissed for that reason. The court wrote, the difference between a procedural and substantive condition precedent is well established. A condition precedent is substantive when it describes acts or events which must occur before a party is obliged to perform a promise made pursuant to an existing contract. In other words, the condition is part of the cause of action and necessary to be alleged and proven, and without this, no cause of action exists. Residential mortgage-backed securities notice and sole remedy provisions are not substantive elements of the cause of action, but instead limitations on the remedy for a breach of the mortgage loan representations and warranties. They serve as a precondition, a procedural prerequisite to suit, not a separate undertaking by the trustee. Since notice and sole remedy provisions do not create a substantive condition precedent, they do not affect when the statute of limitations commences because the limitations clock begins to run when the contract is executed. In another case from the Court of Appeals involving residential mortgage-backed securities, it's U.S. Bank National Association on pages 24 and 25, the court held that the relation back doctrine did not apply to the trustee's breach of contract action here. The Court of Appeals held that the trustee's breach of contract action in this residential mortgage-backed securities case was time-barred. A certificate holder had filed a timely action, but the relevant contract precluded the action by the certificate holder. Therefore, the trustee's action could not be deemed to relate back to it pursuant to CPLR 203. The court said, CPLR 203F has no application here because the certificate holder's pre-existing action was not valid. The lower courts concluded that under the no action clause, the certificate holder could not bring the action on behalf of itself, any other certificate holder, or the trustee. The certificate holder's action was subject to dismissal, and there's no valid pre-existing action to which a claim in a subsequent amended pleading may relate back. Next is the Darko case on page 25. It's another statute of limitations case, and here it involves a motion to extend time to serve the summons and complaint in the interest of justice. Second Department held plaintiff was entitled to an extension of time to serve the summons and complaint in the interest of justice, noting that the statute of limitations had expired when plaintiff made her motion to extend. The court said, "The interest of justice standard requires a careful judicial analysis of the factual setting of the case and a balancing of the competing interests presented by the parties. Unlike an extension requested premised on good cause, a plaintiff seeking an extension in the interest of justice need not establish reasonably diligent efforts at service of the summons and complaint as a threshold matter. However, the court may consider diligence or lack thereof along with any other relevant factor in making its determination, including expiration of the statute of limitations, the potentially meritorious nature of the cause of action, the length of the delay in service, the promptness of a plaintiff's request for an extension of time, and prejudice to the defendant. The statutory 120-day period for service of process commenced in November 2016. In December 2016, the plaintiff attempted service on the defendant on multiple occasions. She promptly moved for an extension of time to serve the summons and complaint after the defendant challenged the service on the ground that it was defective. The statute of limitations had expired at the time the plaintiff made her motion, and there was no demonstrable prejudice to the defendant." Next is MP on page 26. It's another statute of limitations case. This time the court held that the statute was not told while the defendant was out of state, because the defendant could have been served out of state. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, wrote, "The plaintiff's contention that the action was timely because they were entitled to the benefit of the tolling provision of CPLR 207 based on the defendant's alleged absence from the state did not raise a question of fact. Under that statute, as relevant here, when a defendant leaves the state after an action has accrued and is continually absent from the state for at least 4 months, the time of the defendant's absence is not included in the time during which the action must be commenced. This tolling provision, however, does not apply while jurisdiction over the person of the defendant can be obtained without personal delivery of the summons to the defendant within the state. That's CPLR 207.3. In other words, the toll will not apply if there is a means by which the defendant may be served, notwithstanding his or her absence from the state. Here, even during his alleged absence from New York State, the defendant was subject to service of process, and it says see CPLR 302A2, 308.5, and 313. Next is the Birches at Schoharie case, which is on pages 26 and 27. It has to do with the force of an in-court stipulation. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the in-court stipulation was binding, notwithstanding the agreement to memorialize it in writing. The court said, "As a matter of policy, stipulations of settlement are encouraged to promote judicial economy and to provide litigants with the predictability and assurance that courts will honor their prior agreements. The nuance here concerns the additional component of a more specific writing to follow the open court settlement as interjected by the court without objection by counsel. We conclude that the record stipulation constitutes a binding settlement, notwithstanding the parties' dispute over finalizing the written agreement." And moving to the last case, which is Matter of Mental Hygiene Legal Services on page 29, this is a standing case. Here the Mental Health Legal Services attempted to bring an Article 78 to compel a psychiatric hospital to comply with the mental hygiene law. but because the matter wasn't related to a particular client or a particular proceeding, the court, this was the Court of Appeals, determined that the mental health legal services did not have standing to bring the Article 78. The court said, mental health legal services alleges that in early 2016, it began to notice problems with the medical charts offered into evidence by the Bronx Psychiatric Center, because documents contained in the chart had been added or removed just prior to the hearing. The mental health legal services filed this CPLR Article 78 petition in the nature of mandamus in its own name and separate from any specific client or proceeding. And again, the court held that the legal services did not have standing to bring the Article 78. That concludes this half-hour presentation, which will earn one-half credit hour, and which was based upon the civil procedure-related decisions by our New York State appellate courts that were released in February 2019.